melted, and so is the chrome. Who are the brain police? What will you do when the label comes up and the plastic's all melted and the chrome is too
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and other past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. This program wouldn't have been possible without the First Amendment of the Constitution of these United States. Today's program includes overcoming the stigma of mental illness. Psychologist Gail Hornstein talks about her book, Agnes Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meaning of Madness, in this interview, and Millicent Monk talks about her memoir, Songs of Three Islands, the story of mental illness in an iconic American family. It's about how she coped with a mother and a daughter who are mentally ill. Monks is the great-grandniece of Andrew Carnegie. And then after that, on Planet Money, they look at the Egyptian military's deep business ties to everything from dishwashers to resort hotels, and consider how those ties influence how the military responds to the current crisis.
We're talking with Gail Hornstein about the international movement of people diagnosed with mental illness to change the dominant view of madness. Her book is Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness. Now, you went to this Hearing Voices Network, this peer support group, and we should also say that at least in Britain, there were more mental health professionals who were engaged with these groups, but not as not in a one-up position, not in a dominant position.
Not leading these groups, because they really are peer support groups, but there are sympathetic mental health professionals who have sat in on these groups or helped to facilitate them with a voice hearer.
I want to ask you, What was your first impression when you went? I mean, these were among the first groups that you went to. Did you find that you had to overcome some prejudices of your own in terms of, you know, when you were in the presence of people who freely admitted to hallucinations or hearing voices or may have even talked in a way that, you know, typically people would think was irrational?
Well, let me say that, first of all, they rarely talked in a way that people would think was typically irrational, and that was what was so surprising to me. As I said before, I've been to graduate school in psychology. I have a PhD in psychology. I'm a senior psychology professor at Mount Holyoke College. I learned as a graduate student, and since then, the standard viewpoint about people who have these kinds of experiences, like hallucinations, namely, that they are irrational, that they... Again, I'm going to put this in quotes because this is how abnormal psychology textbooks describe it. Lack insight into their own experiences, can't take the role of the other, that is, can't be empathic to other people's experiences because they're so wrapped up in their own. Narcissistic is a word that is often used in abnormal psychology textbooks, I think quite negatively about people's experiences. And when I first started going to Hearing Voices Network support group meetings, what astonished me was that people behaved in ways that had nothing to do with any of the things I had learned as a psychology graduate student and a psychology professor. They were extraordinarily insightful. They were deeply empathic. They were extremely helpful to one another and attuned to one another's feelings and needs. They had a tremendous pragmatic attitude toward making sense of their experiences and helping one another to move beyond them. And I spent many, many hours sitting with the metaphoric equivalent of my jaw dropped as I watched people do things and talk in ways that I had learned in graduate school to think were literally impossible for someone who had been not only diagnosed psychotic, but often these were people who had been in the mental health system for 20 years. They had been hospitalized many times. They had had every medication. They had had shock treatment. They had had every kind of treatment that psychiatry has to offer and had often been given up as people who were doomed to be chronic patients for the rest of their lives. And here they were, sipping tea, thoughtfully analyzing one another's feelings and experiences, making pragmatically helpful suggestions, coming back the following week, making more pragmatically helpful suggestions, even though they were often themselves in very distressing states.
In fact, they were real human beings.
They were completely real human beings, and one of the most important messages of my book, I hope, will come through loud and clear, is that even though we often talk about people with language like, he's a schizophrenic, what we should really be saying is, he's a human being who has had some distressing experiences that psychiatrists might diagnose as schizophrenia. But fundamentally, he's a human being with exactly the same kinds of needs, feelings, levels of insight, etc., as the rest of us.
Our guest today is Gail Hornstein, and we're talking about her book, Agnes's Jacket. You know, I have to make a confession here, and that is that I was a psychiatric social worker, and I actually worked for an emergency services organization. My job was to evaluate people who were in psychological crisis and decide whether they needed to be hospitalized or arrange outpatient mental health treatment for them. I found it a very distressing job, not working with the clients. For me, it was very satisfying to engage with people who were in crisis because I felt they were much more open to real communication, to really thinking and talking through things that were of critical importance. But what I found really distressing were the attitudes of my peers towards the clients, and it seemed to me that the way people would talk about them was very denigrating, you know, and completely against the social work code of ethics, which is really about respecting the client. And I began trying to decide, why was there so much contempt for the client on the part of the people, not all of them, but many of the people that I worked with. And I began to think that it's very challenging, it's very disturbing, it's very threatening to be working with people who have a quote-unquote mental illness. My theory is that people, the professionals, need to protect themselves from the stain, from the contamination of mental illness.
I think that's often true, and it's deeply distressing to all of us. But I think the most important issue here has to do with the pessimism that comes from a theoretical viewpoint that says people cannot get better if they've been diagnosed with a serious mental illness like schizophrenia or psychotic depression or bipolar disorder and so on. What I've learned so powerfully from the experiences that I write about in this book is that people can get better. They do get better, often despite the expectations of the mental health professionals with whom they work. And I think once we begin to take a more realistic, accurate, and essentially optimistic attitude about what people are capable of, we don't need then to have those attitudes, not only of, unfortunately, sometimes contempt, but what's underneath that contempt, fear, that this could happen to us, and if it did happen to us, we too would never be able to recover. I think once you start from the assumption that no matter how seriously distressed someone might be, there is always the possibility and the real potential for them to fully recover and to learn something important from those experiences, then I think you don't have to have such negative attitudes about encountering someone who is in that state. You'd have the same attitude as you would with someone who, for instance, was in a very challenging state of physical crisis, a person who had a frightening disease or a very high fever or had been in a coma or some other kind of very serious problem from which you might well expect they could fully recover. And even though it had been terrifying at the time for them as well as for you, afterwards you would look back and you would say, well, we really learned something very important about the preciousness of life or about the challenges we all have to struggle with or about how vulnerable we all are.
In other words, you would be able to be empathic because you weren't driven by a hidden fear that you might have.
And that's what's so striking about patients themselves in these peer support groups. I think that's why they can be so empathic with each other, is because they hold within them that sense that it's possible for everyone to work through these kinds of difficulties no matter how long they've had them. That's partly what allows people to be empathic, because they go back to a time when they themselves were more distressed and they look to the other person and they say, you can get through this. I did.
Gail Hornstein. You can hear our full interview with her at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Millicent Monks about her memoir, Songs of Three Islands, a story of mental illness in an iconic American family. Stay tuned.
I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew that you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I let myself worry? Wondering what in the world did I do?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Millicent Monks was born into one of the most famous families in America. Her great-grandfather was Andrew Carnegie's brother. Monks grew up among great wealth, spending her summers in Florida on one private island owned by her family, and most of her adulthood on two others off the coast of Maine. But wealth and privilege did not insulate her family from tragedy. Suicide, alcoholism, and mental illness were a legacy passed from generation to generation. Monks's great-grandmother and mother suffered from mental illness, possibly manic depression, and her own daughter was diagnosed at age 18 with what is now called borderline personality disorder. Monks's memoir, Songs of Three Islands, tells the story of her struggle as both the daughter and the mother of women who are mentally ill, and how she was able to find healing in her own life. This is a beautiful book, Songs of Three Islands. Beautiful and tragic, I have to say, although it doesn't end tragically. A story of mental illness in an iconic American family. That iconic family is the family of Andrew Carnegie, who was your great uncle, is that right?
Right.
And the three islands are estates that are owned by your family. One is in the south, off the coast of Georgia, and the other two are off the coast of Maine. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's where you are right now.
We're in the what you call a middle island, I guess.
Now, I get the sense in reading your book that these islands are both very real, loved and beautiful places for you, but they're also metaphors.
Yes.
Let's start with the real first. Tell us a little bit about the island you live on now and the one that you lived on when you were a girl. And your mother lived there as a young girl.
Yes, she lived there. That's Cumberland Island, and the young John Kennedy was married there, in the little church there. And I remember going there until I was about seven, and then World War II started. I have to say that because nobody knows what war I'm talking about since I'm 77 years old. You know, they think it's the Vietnam War or something. So anyway, I was there until I was about seven, and the war broke out, and it was still very lovely, and the houses were beautiful. And then after the war, it really fell apart. The Park Service took quite a bit of it over.
By eminent domain.
Yes. It was very unpleasant.
Yeah, I would think so. And now the island that you live on, actually that island, the one in Georgia, Cumberland Island, just seemed like an almost magical place.
Well, I think it was my great-grandfather and his wife had nine children, and they all lived there. And it was magical, but I'm afraid it was a bit of a brigadoon, you know, a place you couldn't leave because you weren't prepared for the world. Because they had so much. You know, they had everything that they wanted. Big boats and tennis courts and golf courts and people visiting all the time and big houses. And they weren't prepared for the world, really. My grandfather always said that he wished he had had a college education.
Because?
Well, he never got one because he took over running the island.
And then he wasn't really fit for the real world?
That's, I think, what he felt, yes.
And in a way, your mother and you also didn't really feel fit for the real world.
I think my mother wasn't altogether well. And, excuse me, I lived with her alone in Boston for about 7 years, I guess it was. And that was difficult.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about a legacy that maybe even started earlier than your mother, with your grandmother, of mental disturbance. I mean, it's not clear maybe that your grandmother suffered, but there are indications. Say a little bit about the affliction.
Well, I really don't know. It was my great-grandmother. My grandmother was fine. The great-grandmother who had the nine children, and she ended up at McLean's Hospital in Boston. But nobody really does seem to know whether it was what just, you know, you didn't talk about mental illness in those days. You still don't talk much about it. But in those days, it was really taboo to talk about it. So it's not really part of the family history except that she was there.
You know, it was interesting. I do remember that you grew up in Boston, but I kept on having the feeling when you were talking about growing up with your mother that you were on an island. So I think here is where the metaphor comes in. Talk a little bit about island as metaphor for you in this book, Songs of Three Islands.
Okay. I'm a TM meditator and a Siddha. And in the Vedic tradition, first the child is with the mother, and then the child leaves the mother and goes to the next stage, which is family, and their own children and their own family. And then the last stage is the spiritual stage, where the elders go into the forest to explore the spiritual life, because life is coming to an end. So that's the way I see the three islands.
Oh, and so the first one being the one
with a mother,
with your mother within the bosom of the family. I mean, those, the other sense I have about the island is that it is a place where you're isolated. And I was so struck, I think the reason why I kept on thinking of you as growing up on an island, even though you were right in the middle of Boston, was because you were terribly isolated as a child. Tell us what your childhood was like. What was going on between you and your mother?
I think she became kind of frightening for me. So I would, I didn't get fed very well, and I would lock myself in my room after school just because that felt safe. It was really scary. I began to think if I looked in a mirror that I'd see her face instead of mine. It was not a happy growing up.
Why were you afraid of her?
She would stand behind curtains, and you wouldn't know she was there. She got very, very angry. She had a secretary who she'd get absolutely furious with. She ended up having the control over me, so she ended up telling me I was full of poisoned milk from my father's farm. They had unpasteurized milk, and that I was a rape baby. And then she managed to put me in the hospital for about 3 weeks to see if they couldn't get rid of the poisoned milk. So that was pretty spooky.
What a metaphor that is, the poisoned milk.
Yes.
And that you are a rape baby. I mean, she wasn't. Your father left when you were fairly young.
Yes, he did.
You describe in your book, Songs of Three Islands, a childhood in which it sounds much more profoundly frightening even than what you've described here. You were not fed. You were not taken care of. You were not looked after. You were identified as evil in some way by your mother. Very, very, it just tore at my heartstrings to read about it. And I kept on thinking, where was everybody else? You had a large family, you had a father, you had grandparents and aunts and uncles. What happened to them? Why didn't they intervene?
Well, I did go down to stay with my aunt in Greenwich quite a bit, but it was the war. So my father was off in New Guinea, and my brother was in Europe, and my sister would not come home. She decided she was never going to come home again, so she left and went somewhere. And I wasn't allowed to see my paternal grandmother, who was around.
By your mother?
By my mother, right.
Mm-hmm.
Or any of my father's relatives. So during the war, things were pretty bleak.
And after the war?
And after the war, well, then I went to boarding school.
And you say that when you were, actually, first you went to camp and then you went to this boarding school. You say that you always felt that you were a stranger in the world. And you connect that to the lack of love.
It's interesting. When I talk to other people that have had terribly difficult times with mothers, I think they feel somewhat that way too. And I think very often they become psychic as a way of protection, which has been kind of interesting because so many of them, that seems to be what happens.
Have a yen to go back once again, back to the place where no one wears a frown, to see once more those super special, just plain folks in my hometown. No fella could ignore the little girl next door. She sure looked sweet in her first evening gown. Now there's a charge for what she used to give for free in my hometown. I remember Dan, the druggist on the corner. He was never mean or ornery, he was swell. He killed his mother-in-law and ground her up real well, and sprinkled just a bit over each banana split. The guy that taught us math, who never took a bath, acquired a certain measure of renown. And after school he sold the most amazing pictures in my hometown. That fellow was no fool who taught our Sunday school, and neither was our kindly Parson Brown. We're recording tonight, so I'll have to leave this line out. In my hometown, I remember Sam. He was the village idiot, and though it seems a pity it was so, he loved to burn down houses just to watch the glow. And nothing could be done because he was the mayor's son. The guy that took a knife and monogrammed his wife, then dropped her in the pond and watched her drown. Oh yes, indeed, the people there are just plain folks in my hometown.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.